show. Head on to Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! My goodness gracious, it's Moran Monday on the horn. And I've got a stack thick enough to... I think we could do a horn telethon. But we won't. Just 3 little hours of conversation radio like we always do. My apologies. My apologies for Friday. I just couldn't get out of my meeting in time enough to... Well, these things happen. I'm sorry. This is the horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Your home for conversation radio. A little bit different and bubble off plum as compared to anything anybody else is doing. And one of the nice things about that is that it seems to be something that y'all appreciate. And that is gratifying indeed. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, like I said, is our home. That's where the Listen Live button is. If you're using Windows Media Player, that thing comes in handy. But there are other ways of listening as well. And including the various and sundry different non-Windows Media Player oriented streams that you can also find over at WhiteRoseSociety.org under the subdomain for this program, where also you will find the podcast address for this and Dr. Bill's subdomain, the podcast address for his program. You can also get the podcast at iTunes. I was moving into auctioneer mode there now, wasn't I? Of course, remember, apps like TuneIn Radio and Stitcher Internet Radio make it more than possible for you to take the horn with you on the go via your tablet or smartphone devices. So that's what, you know, that's where the future is. It really is. Our friends over at Progressive Voices have their own channel on TuneIn, and isn't that cool? I'll tell you this. I was invited to contribute content for that. I just have to figure out a way to... you want to make a project? 3 minutes. If you hear 3 minutes of really awesome radio, shoot me a note. Tell me when it happened, you know, roughly where it is. I'll go into the archives, pull it, and we'll start submitting that for the Progressive Voices drops. Because I'm really, really hard on my own... on my own work, and I'm hard pressed to pick out 3 minutes and go, damn, that was good. See, by the way, just a gentle reminder, you all know this, unless you're absolutely brand new, positively spanking, shining, new to the program, this all happens due to listener support. So I want to thank everybody, first of all, who got us started last week. Unfortunately, we find ourselves still in a hole from July. And so tonight's fundraising goal is roughly $450. And that brings us pretty close to even with finishing up July and keeping even with August. So 45 folks, 10 bucks a piece. Can we do that? Thanks to subscription subscribers. You know, you can subscribe at headonradionetwork.com. And we got a subscription in earlier today. And we are deeply, deeply grateful for that. It makes things a little bit easier if you want to use the subscription button at whatever, you know, whatever rate or amount you choose to select. So thank you very much. Thank you to Kevin in Colorado Springs for his contribution today. That actually changed us from we're actually at 420 and not 450. 420. Who knew? So. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where the PayPal button is. Also, under the tab Contribute, you will find the snail mail address. Oh, did I say snail mail? I'm so sorry. That's a near 8-year habit or whatever. The traditional mail address. which, by the way, is the Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V, 25801. Remember, checks and money orders should not be made payable to Bob Kincaid, as Bob Kincaid does not see the same. They go to the credit union, whereat the bills get paid as we can pay them. So, thanks for all of that. Randy wants to know, does a subscription have fees taken out of it by PayPal? Yeah, the same old fees apply. That's just, you know, that's how it works out. But, you know, I got to thinking about it, the difference between that. And I mean, I understand some people just don't like to deal with PayPal, and I get that. On the other hand, $3 on 100, roughly 3%, hell. Boss man Wayne burns up $3 worth of gas going to the mailbox. So it works out about even, any way you want to slice it. But anyway, like I said, we've got enough More in Monday material for a telethon. Really, there is probably about 24 hours maybe worth of material here. Obviously, we're not going to get to it all, but I'm going to try to hit as many licks as I possibly can. Some breaking news as we begin the week. Now, this just in, Texas Betsy telling me when she contributes, she pays no fees because she has a PayPal account. So I don't know really how that works. Breaking news as we approach the broadcast hour. From the New York Times, oddly enough, not from the Washington Post, go figure. Jeff Bezos has personally, and they have gone to great pains to make this plain, has personally, not on behalf of Amazon.com, but personally, done went and bought the Washington Post. Howdy do. We shall see now what comes of that. I'm imagining it'll be more profiteering and less journalizing, but that's because I'm me and I'm a cynic. It went for what strikes me. I don't know. Are newspapers just not worth that much money anymore? The Washington Post went to Jeffrey P. Bezos. Bezos? Bezos? It's Bezos, isn't it? For what would seem to be a paltry $250 million. Hell, the Powerball jackpot's higher than that, isn't it? You mean to tell me that if some listener to the Horn hits the Powerball for $400 million, you can go and buy the newspaper in the nation's capital, the home of the expose of Watergate, and golly Moses. Now, Catherine Weymouth and Donald E. Graham have said that Mr. Bezos has kindly told them that they can keep their day jobs and they won't have to go on relief. I am honored to continue as CEO and publisher, Ms. Weymouth said in a statement. I have asked the entire senior management team at all of the business being sold to continue in their roles as well. Nothing in there about the proles who are down there cranking out the journalism. They may be 50 cent per ad bloggers by the time Mr. Bezos gets done. We don't know. But it's not a happy time for journalism right now. I took note of that story because of a note that I received from Dr. John late last week. Another newspaper company, in this case the Gannett Company, a publisher of 81 U.S. newspapers, and not doing any too shabby as a corporation either. In 2012, Gannett earned profits of $1.78 per share, according to Dr. John, on revenues of $5.35 billion. That's a 3% increase since 2011. And you know what? Under current circumstances, if you're doing 3%, you're damn sure keeping up with inflation. And nobody's eating beans. Well, somebody's eating beans. The Gannett Company, publisher of 81 U.S. newspapers, including the Courier-Journal in Louisville, And isn't the Nashville Tennessean also a Gannett paper? I think so. The Detroit News and a host of small community papers started doing stealth layoffs last week. As of the afternoon of Thursday, August the 1st, Dr. John tells me there had been over 200 folks, mostly news staff, that's important, in the newspaper business, who were out of work as of Thursday afternoon, August the 1st. On the other hand, most of Gannett's papers hadn't even announced the total damage as of the time of Dr. John's note. Dr. John says word is a couple of smaller papers might go entirely online. I've also heard that the paper in Salem has laid off all of its reporting staff, and Burlington has lost 13 from its newsroom, which wasn't that big to begin with. All this follows layoffs of 800 journalists in June 2011. Let's review. In 2012, Gannett earned profits of $1.78 per share on revenues of $5.35 billion, up nearly 3% from 2011. So, once again, the money boys are doing okay. The money boys and girls. The people who actually make the news, who sweated their way through 4 years of journalism school, or maybe even did it the old traditional way, starting out with the police blotter and moving up or moving down or laterally to learn to write obituaries and all of that, you know, ink on your fingertips kind of gritty down in the, you know, there was a great movie with Humphrey Bogart in the late 40s, I think. But, you know, everything, you know, the young Hemingway started out covering the police morgue beat for the Kansas City Star and moved up from there, Kansas City Star, moved from there to Toronto. And long before his first short stories were lost in Gare du Nord in Paris, and he had to turn around and rewrite all of them, so the myth goes. He was a budding journalist who had never had a day in college. Then it became a worthy course of study in colleges, because it's not just something you do. And there are lots of people out there, some of whom are my age and still paying off student loans from getting that master's in journalism, or maybe even a post hole digger. PhD in journalism. And the profiteers are killing the business. They're not just strangling the goose that lays the golden eggs. They're chopping it into tiny enough sized pieces for dim sum. But it's pretty shocking, those two stories taken together. A publisher of 81 newspapers that had a 3% rise in profits in 2012 goes through massive layoffs in early August, and 3 days later, 4 days later, we find out that the Washington Post is being sold to the Amazon guy. And of course, we're supposed to understand that Amazon is a model of a model of entrepreneurship and wealth generation for the internet age. Remembering, of course, that President Not Sure showed up in Chattanooga, Tennessee last week. I think we mentioned that. Showed up in Chattanooga, Tennessee last week to tout $13 an hour jobs, tops, at an Amazon warehouse as the revival of the middle class. Harumph, you know? Right. It's just one of those things. When I drive to and from Washington, D.C., as I frequently do these days, there is not a single time, I don't think even at like 3 o'clock in the morning, when at some point in time I-66 going into D.C. or out of it slows to a crawl. Because D.C. is a relatively small place, and it's extremely expensive to inhabit. So you wind up spending 4 hours of every day of your life sitting in a car parked on an asphalt strip on your way home. Boom. And you come to the end of your days and you start doing the multiplication. Let's see. 4 hours a day, 5 hours, 20 hours a week, 50. Jesus Christ, I've spent most of my life sitting in a car. Wow. So one wonders how the actual working journalists of the Washington Post will fare on those $13 an hour salaries, if they can get that. Thanks going out to Darlene. She said, one of my wayward clients finally paid their bill, so I hope this helps, Bob. Thanks for all you do. Well, thank you for making it possible to continue doing what we all do here, Darlene. She's put $100 on the table. And if that is matched up by another $100, that will take us almost halfway. Well, yeah, right at, considering what came in earlier today, right at halfway to taking care of not just tonight's program, but getting us halfway out of the hole that we're still in. We can see the top of the hole now. So thank you. And thank you very kindly to Sal for responding. We only need 9 more folks to respond to Darlene's $100 challenge, and, well, there we are. So thanks very kindly. Thanks. Now, where to go? Good Lord in heaven. It is after... Oh, wait a minute. I'm screwing this all up, aren't I? Yeah, there we go. There we go. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right up, step right up. It's Moran Monday on the horn. Behind this thin veil of cybernetic canvas reside racist morans, homophobic morans, totalitarian morans, authoritarian morans, right-wing morans, teabagging morans, morans, morans everywhere. You can't tell the program without a moran, and this is the program that tells the morans you just can't tell them much. Head for the hills, or you'll be up to your armpits in morans. Oh yes indeedy. Oh, let's start here. There is another Bill O'Brien on the planet. And this one is not nearly as genial or as intelligent as our Bill O'Brien. This Bill O'Brien lives in New Hampshire, where, not too long back, Americans for Prosperity held an event there to declare that the heavens would fall, children would, I don't know, disrespect their parents, and we would all lose our Frisbees and wheat checks because of Obamacare. Yes, this Bill O'Brien is another one of that breed of Bill O'Briens. Different Bill O'Briens, because there's several of them. But this Bill O'Brien, no, he's not the kind of fella who tries to foster a greater understanding of how it is that our country actually came into being and works and or doesn't work. No, this Bill O'Brien is a teabagger, and he wants you to understand just how dangerous Obamacare truly is.
What is Obamacare? It is a law as destructive to personal and individual liberty as the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 that allowed slave owners to come to New Hampshire and seize African Americans and use the federal courts to take them back to federal, to slave states.
You got that? Yeah. Oh, Margaret, go get the net. Don't really know what to do with these types anymore. Here in the near future, I expect we're going to be having a conversation with a book author, a fellow by the name of Chuck Thompson. Just got. I spent a big part of the weekend reading his book. It's called Better Off Without Him, A Northern Manifesto for Southern Secession. And, of course, it's really just a travelogue. And there's some entertainment in it. But the heart and soul of it is that the South is holding America back from reaching America's true potential and righting the wrongs and righting the ship of state and plugging the holes. And it's going to... I mean, let's assume Alabama stand's gone. No more Tennessee stand. No more Georgia stand. Take note, please, that the accent in this audio is decidedly not from Mississippi stand.
And what is Obamacare? It is a law as destructive to personal and individual liberty as the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 that allowed slave owners to come to New Hampshire and seize African Americans and use the federal courts to take them back to federal, to slave states.
Yeah, the more ends ye have always with ye. But it's one thing to simply note that someone like this Bill O'Brien, not our Bill O'Brien, I think the only thing these two have in common is the fact they both have a beard. But then again, so do I, so, yeah, no. This Bill O'Brien, it's one thing just to point at him and go, yeah, yeah, moron. It is another thing entirely, however, to take a look at what passes for the substance of his comments. To wit, if we were to try to describe this mathematically, Obamacare equals sign Fugitive Slave Act. Can we take it as read that everybody here knows what the Fugitive Slave Act did? Can we take it as read that it was pressed not by a bunch of Northerners, but in fact by the plantation-owning class of the Deep South? Yeah. Can we take it, in fact, that the Fugitive Slave Act has absolutely nothing whatsoever in common with the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act? That's the name of the bill, you know. It gets a little tiresome to hear left, right, and sundry. What left? Referring to Obamacare. I'm a big one for the proper names of things. It's not Supreme Court. It's the Supreme Court of the United States. It's the Senate of the United States. The House of Representatives of the United States. The Constitution of the United States. And the name of this particular bill is the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Not Obamacare. But that appears to be what we're going to be calling it. But it, in turn, tries to offer access to health care for people who don't have it. to make it affordable for people who, up until now, could not afford it. It is not a vicious program whereby people can be dragged from one state into another. Although, to be fair, the Medicaid expansion program and the fact that the old Confederacy states and several allies refuse to participate in the Medicaid expansion does create a free, something similar to states that are free and not free. In Alabama, you are free to live and work and pray to sweet, saintly, bleeding Jesus every day that you don't get sick and have to go to the doctor or, God forbid, the hospital or need surgery. On the other hand, as people like Tracy have pointed out to us from California, when she had to have brain surgery, she was able to get coverage because that state thinks that just because you aren't a member of the J.P. Gottrocks family, you're not therefore deemed second class and without access to life-saving medicine. So Bill O'Brien got it wrong by getting it upside down. We do have a bifurcated nation. And it is a nation that is bifurcated along wealth and privilege lines. But do I have to mention to you, I probably don't, that Bill O'Brien is, of course, a white guy. Call me crazy, but I can't imagine that there's just a whole bunch of dark-skinned members of the Tea Party in the Granite State. Maybe. But I doubt it. And that's, I guess the strangest thing about this is that when you're a white guy standing up talking to other white guys and white women, it is absolutely lost on you that maybe comparing slavery to being able to get health insurance is just a teensy, tiny, itsy, bitsy little bit offensive. Since Bill O'Brien here is one of those small government types, you can well imagine, were he to get in the Wayback Machine and travel back to, say, 1863 or 1864, or perhaps the passage of the 13th Amendment in the Congress in 1865, that he would be braying like the upright walking horse's ass he is about big government and big government constitutional amendments. And this is an open question for these guys. How do you make them any less the racists that they are? Or do you just have to wait for human mortality to take care of that for us? Lord, we've been waiting a long time for this one. Flush Flimball. No, there's no audio, so Marty, you can keep the volume up. Flush Flimball showed up on to talk to Greta Van Susteren on Radio Rwanda to talk about the Detroit bankruptcy, wherein he offered this gem. You have massive welfare states where citizens are given things left and right in order to buy their votes. You have no opposition whatsoever.
And in the case of the, you throw race into the mix and you bring on Mayor Coleman Young, who causes riots in 1967 in Detroit, and Mayor Young caused a white flight to suburbs, and Detroit is left with nothing but liberal Democrats running it. It is what it is. And you, any place in this country that has similar circumstances, the same fate is going to happen to them.
Yes, yep. The Negroes are going to bankrupt your city too. Because all the nice white people got scared away by all the scary brown people. I mean, you wish there was a remedy to this crap. But I'm hard-pressed to suggest to you that it is. Or that there is. And the funny thing is, there is no price to be paid for this kind of blatant racism. Because it is that. It is racist to say that health care coverage is the equivalent of a law that allowed slave-owning whites to chase down escaped slaves. That's racist. It is racist. Insofar as it asserts that one's privilege... Not privilege. Insofar as it asserts that having health care is the equivalent to 135 years of bond servitude and the ownership of human beings, and then another 100 years of Jim Crow apartheid. I mean, it's not just stupid. It's racist. Would you be shocked if I told you that Bill O'Brien delivered his speech in New Hampshire while wearing a sheet and a pillowcase hat? No. I wouldn't if you told me. He wasn't, but he might as well have been. That's why 1L Michelle Bachmann is in such a damn dither. She has called on my thanks go out to our buddy Joe for the clip. Not going to play, and for the story, I'm not going to play any audio. Sorry, but Charlie Rangel called the teabaggers like they are, and 1L Michelle Bachmann, doing her, valedictory turn in the House, is wildly upset. For those keeping score at home, that's Minnesota's Michelle Bachmann, not Alabama's Michelle Bachmann. Although it is worth remembering that presidential timber tester Scott Walker of Wisconsin has been said to have Alabama values, and I still don't know why those bumpers, why those billboards aren't all over the state of Wisconsin yet. Charlie Rangel sat down for an interview with the Daily Beast. Speaking about the teabaggers, he said, "It is the same group we faced in the South with those white crackers and the dogs and the police. They didn't care about how they looked. It was just fierce indifference to human life that caused America to say enough is enough. I don't want to see it, and I'm not part of it. What the hell? If you have to bomb little kids and send dogs out against human beings, give me a break." teabag and darling, Michelle 1L, was incensed. She tweeted, or someone tweeted, that's on her payroll and has not yet been indicted.
Charlie Rangel should apologize to Tea Party members. I'll set up meetings so he can explain his outrageous comments.
That's right. White privilege Michelle Bachmann has commanded the dark-skinned man to come and explain himself. There you go. And she's apparently pissed off that he used the word cracker. Language lesson for 1L Michelle. The origin of the word cracker appears to go back to a term used for people like my Scots-Irish ancestors and the fact that they lived a largely subsistence diet based upon ground corn, or cracked corn, as in Jimmy cracked corn and I don't care. Crackers, not saltines. Not the little things that bob around in your oyster stew or your clam chowder. Cracked corn. And, interestingly, white folks used it on other white folks. Cracker. And she's outraged. Even though Charlie Rangel did not say that the teabaggers... He did not say the teabaggers were crackers. He said it is the same group we faced in the South with those white crackers and the dogs and the police. In other words, the groups in the South were the ones who were crackers with dogs and police. Oh, but Michelle is very upset. You know why she's upset? She's upset for the same reason Limbaugh and Nugent and the likers. Well, they can say cracker, but we can't say the N-word. Why not? Yeah, being informed here that National Petroleum Radio seems to think that the word cracker goes back to the crack of the whip. And cracker, according to Jelani Cobb at the University of Connecticut, was used to refer to poor whites, particularly those inhabiting the frontier regions of Maryland, Virginia, and Georgia. In other words, my Scots-Irish ancestors. It's suspected it was a shortened version of whipcracker, since the manual labor they did involved driving livestock with a whip, not to mention other brutal arenas where their skills were employed. Over the course of time, it came to represent a person of lower caste or criminal disposition. And it goes on... there's even a reference to cracker in Shakespeare, but it very much was a term begun used by whites against other whites. So that's as far as that's going to go this evening. But Michelle Bachmann wants you to understand that she's incensed, and that Charlie Rangel had better show up. She's scheduling a meeting for him to answer questions, because she has that right. Never mind that she's been in the Congress. Never mind. She's very angry. Never mind the fact that the teabaggers, they are the descendants of the people who had the hoses and the dogs.
and the shovels. Yeah. And then, just to continue with the theme, because we're just working through it all, little by little, we have to go back to Radio Rwanda's business host, Stuart Varney, who got his start at Chicken Noodle News. And he's working the same side of the street, just a little further down it. The same side of the street as Bill O'Brien. Because remember, Obamacare is the same thing as being able to hunt you down if you escape from the plantation. Right? Only with the wrong accent. Mine being the wrong one. And, right. So, you know, same with food.
Food's ruining the economy. That's how many Americans are collecting food stamps right now. A 70% spike since 2008. But the AARP says that's not enough, and it's trying to recruit seniors to apply for the government handout. Why would they want to encourage a welfare state? Stuart Varney joins us right now. Stuart, good morning to you.
It's called buying votes, actually. Have you ever heard of that?
It's happening in Pennsylvania.
Oh, my goodness. It's called buying votes, by Jove. You got that?
47.6 million. That's how many Americans are collecting food stamps right now. A 70% spike since 2008. But the AARP says that's not enough and is trying to recruit seniors to apply for the government handout. Why would...
The government handout. Government handout. Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits. Paid for by the taxpayers of this country are a government handout. They are not. Do you see how the trope develops? It's a government handout because we can't dare let the nonagenarians and octogenarians back home watching, we can't for a minute let them recall that everything, if you're listening to Dr. Bill, you already know this, most of the non-economic underpinnings, the philosophical underpinnings of this country have to do with the concept of the commonweal, the commonwealth. Hence why some states are still considered commonwealths, because that was the way one referred to a political subdivision at the time, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Commonwealth of Kentucky, Commonwealth of Old Virginia. Right? It's not a matter of us taking care of us. It's a government handout, as if there was a crown up there saying, "Here, small person, eat a crumb falling from my table, and you may then tug your forelock and thank me profusely for being the beneficent monarch that I am and not cutting your filthy head off." Right? Government handout.
47.6 million. That's how many Americans are collecting food stamps right now. A 70% spike since 2008. But the AARP says that's not enough and is trying to recruit seniors to apply for the government handout. Why would they want to encourage a welfare state? Stuart Varney joins us right now. Stuart, good morning to you.
It's called buying votes, actually. Have you ever heard of that?
It's happening in Pennsylvania,
exactly,
right?
What it is. It's happening in Pennsylvania, Georgia, and a couple of other states, New York included.
What about pride? What about pride in not getting food stamps because I don't need them?
Okay, the AARP is...
All right. And the guy who said that was the asshat who isn't Steve Doocy and isn't the attack blonde and isn't Stuart Varney. What about pride?
It's called buying votes, actually. Have you ever heard of that?
It's happening in Pennsylvania,
exactly,
right?
Exactly what it is. It's happening in Pennsylvania, Georgia, and a couple of other states, New York included.
What about pride? What about pride in not getting food stamps because I don't need them?
Okay.
Well, asshat who isn't Steve Doocy. Let's discuss this. What about pride in not needing them? SNAP is a brutally means-tested program. If you qualify as food insecure, which is a sort of Orwellian way of saying hungry American, you get a piss-poor allotment. Piss-poor allotment of SNAP benefits on a monthly basis. If you do not need them, what is this asshat? And if I knew him by name, I'd tell you, but I don't. He's just the asshat who isn't Steve Doocy. The pride at not needing them is, what, there but for the grace of God go I? I am favored by the Almighty, for I have enough food to eat. Is that the new standard of wealth being advocated by Fox News? If that's the case, then we're not progressing toward the idiocracy world that I mentioned Friday night, or Thursday night, in terms of millennia. You know, where the English language had become a hybrid of hillbilly, valley girl, urban slang, and a series of grunts. We're there! Carl's Jr., F you, I'm eating. Come back when you've got some money. We're there! What about the pride of not being on food stamps? Well, if you can't afford food and you're not on food stamps, go to McDonald's while nobody's looking. Get you some hot water and some ketchup and stir it together. Throw in all the salt and pepper you can get into it for flavor. And then season it up with your pride. Or maybe take comfort in your pride while you're dumpster diving to feed your hungry children. Or in the case of seniors, your hungry grandchildren, because we got a lot of seniors raising grandbabies these days. In this America that Steve Doocy, Stuart Varney, the attack blonde, and this asshat don't live in.
The AARP is trying to sign up seniors. Come on in, sign up for food stamps. If you're eligible, you are entitled. That's what they're saying. They're meeting some resistance because some of the older generation say, come on, that's not the way we work things. We're here to what can we do for you as opposed to what can the government do for me? Mm-hmm. That's what's happening. Now,
But the bottom line is Stuart Varney's thesis that it's about buying votes. It's that simple. It's just buying votes. It's not about buying food. It's not about supporting the massive retail food infrastructure. It's not about the indirect corporate welfare that the SNAP program amounts to for the Ralphs and the Walmarts and the Krogers and the A&Ps and all the food lands and the IGAs and what have you. It's not about that. It's about vote buying, because you know what? If starvation has not weakened you to the point where you cannot get to the polls, then you might go to the polls, and if you can get past all the bizarre and Byzantine the vote suppression techniques, and you cast a vote, you might cast a vote in favor of somebody that believes in you continuing to be able to eat enough to get to the polls next time. Jesus! Do, please, for I cannot wait. Continue, Stuart Varney.
Some resistance, because some of the older generation say, come on, that's not the way we work things. We're here to, what can we do for you?
Now, when I was growing up, we lived in a box. We would have been lucky to have a box. We sat around nights wishing we had a box. We lived over a warm sewer grate.
Stuart Varney, take your Monty Python Yorkshireman shtick and stick it with, well, you know. It's vote buying, that's what it is. Vote buying. See what I mean? We could go on like this for hours. Because there's tons of it. And we'll get to as many as we possibly can in the time allotted to us. But it's a challenge. I kid you not. We have, for instance, the tale of Sister Simone Campbell and representing Reed Ribble.
Sounds like a bubble in a bathtub.
Who testified before, and I imagine she did some praying before she did. She's a Roman Catholic nun. Somehow I have more respect for the nuns these days than I do their priestly counterparts. Or their bosses, really. Network, NETWORK, is a Catholic social justice lobby, and she's the executive director, Sister Simone Campbell is, of Network. She's also a nun. She testified before Congress about government-subsidized welfare programs and how they help public-private partnerships with faith-based charities. We will save the government in bed with faith-based charities discussion for later and just take it as read that Sister Campbell is doing the best she can within the paradigm in which she works. And she pointed out to the House of Representatives in committee assembled that most of these organizations are funded by foundations. And that the foundations never have enough money to go around. Having worked with groups that are foundationally supported, I can tell you that the constant, and it is a full-time job finding foundations that will write a check to help your group continue their work. And the same thing happens with foundations that work for feeding people. She said that things like SNAP, that we were just talking about, as well as the Earned Income Tax Credit and Head Start program, she said that they're, those are net positives, but when you cut those things, it's bad for the people who need those things. Enter Reed Ribble, bubble in bathtub, for what can only be described as a contentious exchange. Because Reed Ribble is a Republican from Wisconsin. Used to be Wisconsin elected Republicans because they were, well, if you were listening to the previous hour, 2 hours of Dr. Bill, you know that they were the origins of progressivism in many instances. And that in the 1912 election, it was a progressive contest between Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt. All right. Well, Reed Ribble wasn't having none of this food stamps are good for people business from Sister Simone. No. He was going to mansplain to her where and how she was wrong. And that's what led Reed Ribble. I know. That's what led Reed Ribble to ask her, what is the church doing wrong that they have come to the government to get so much help? I'm the last guy to defend anybody's church, right? And we are more than harsh on the Roman Catholic variety, way past harsh in light of the fact that they've been, for several generations now, running a rape ring and moving money around, for instance, to cemetery funds to hide it from bankruptcy judges and stuff like that. But in this instance, how can you not defend Sister Simone Campbell when she brooking no BS from Reed Ribble, said justice comes before charity. Everyone has a right to eat, and therefore there is a governmental responsibility to ensure everyone's capacity to eat. Love and care makes a difference, but the issues are so big, there isn't sufficient charitable dollars there. It is worth noting that Catholic Charities gets over half of its operating budget from federal funds. And it doesn't even begin to touch the problem. Not at all. Not even. But, well, Alan Pike, last Wednesday, over at Think Progress, noted that the Republicans, who seek to cut vast amounts of money from the food stamp SNAP budget, that the real world effect of that would be to throw 5 million American people off of the SNAP program, and that the outgrowth of that will be health problems from lack of sufficient nutrition that will cost more in this country than the cuts will save. In other words, the Republicans are being penny-wise, pound foolish. A study was done by the Health Impact Project. Here's how the numbers bang out. $20.5 billion in proposed cuts from SNAP will mean that as many as 5.1 million people lose eligibility for the program. 83% of those receiving SNAP benefits are already below the poverty line. Of those families below the poverty line, that would mean a 38% cut in their family budgets. That's huge. That's 12 percentage points from half of the budget. There is previous peer-reviewed scientific research that shows that children who get food stamps are healthier adults than low-income children who grow up without food aid. What about being proud of not being on food stamps? And thus it is that the report from the Health Impact Project projects that a $15 billion increase over 10 years in healthcare costs will be related to diabetes alone. Three-fourths of the $20.5 billion cuts will come from a rise in diabetes. Just diabetes. Heart disease also goes up. Asthma goes up. Mental health problems. Oh, yeah. And then, of course, there's the economic benefit, which the money folks are supposed to pay attention to. Every dollar in SNAP benefits yields $1.70 in economic activity. So we got 5 million Americans planned to be cut from the food stamp program, and yet already in this country, right now, as you and I converse, there are 50 million in a country of some 350 million. There are 50 million, one-seventh of the population going hungry. Most of them. And you would think the teabaggers would care, but they don't. Most of those are white folks. That I guess the other asshat, who isn't the attack blonder Steve Doocy at Fox News, Radio Rwanda, figures are getting along just fine by being proud of the fact that they ain't taking none of that government handout. So we have that. Because it's Moran Monday. And since we've been talking about children, let's continue with this Moran Monday nomination for the whoever it is in Texas that sets policy for foster children. Story comes from KVUE in Texas. Texas Betsy naturally sent this along. On Monday night, Joshua Hill's daughter, Alexandria, or Alex as they like to call her, was rushed to a Rockdale hospital with severe head injuries, then flown to Scott and White Children's Emergency Hospital in Temple, and immediately placed on life support. She was a little one. Alexandria was living with foster parents after the Department of Family and Family Protective Services removed her from her parents' home last November for neglectful supervision. What was the neglectful supervision? Joshua Hill had admitted that he and Alex's mommy, when baby would go to sleep at night, at the end of a long day, would, as the old saying goes, fire up a number. Once baby was asleep, it was just the grown-ups, mommy and daddy would catch a little buzz. We never hurt our daughter, he said. She was never sick, she was never in the hospital, and she never had any issues until she went into state care. She was put into two separate foster homes. When they would visit with her, because they still loved her and didn't want her to go in the first place, Alex's parents noticed that she had bruises on her body and mold in her bag. Joshua Hill told Child Protective Services that they'd have to put him in jail because he didn't want to return her to the foster home. So then they put her in a second home, and now she's dead. And the foster mother has been arrested after her description of what happened to little Alex didn't match the injuries little Alex sustained. Foster mommy admitted that she slammed little Alex's head. She is charged with murder. The state alleged that mommy and daddy had limited parenting skills because little Alex was staying with her grandparents. She was fine, and then she wasn't. She was fine, and then she was dead. Told you that you know, they want you to understand that pot is bad for you. And so, let's go ahead and do this story as we perhaps wind up the filibobster. We go to Calhoun County, Alabama, and a story out of WBRC. Calhoun County is where Anniston is. Story goes back to July 26th, and a 911 call said little Gregory Carver was having problems breathing. He was transported to Stringfellow Memorial Hospital, where he died. India Kimball, 28 years old, and 26-year-old Vonta McClellan were charged with murder. According to Calhoun County District Attorney Brian McVeigh, the male is charged with capital murder in that he beat this child over an extended period of time, 5-year-old child with a belt, and the child ultimately died of multiple blunt force trauma injuries from that beating. The mother of the child is also charged with capital murder in that she aided and abetted. The allegations against her are that she kept the child in an environment where domestic violence was taking place and child abuse, and on that particular day that she participated in verbal abuse of a child and kept the child there while the child was being beaten and didn't call the police, didn't call for help, didn't do anything that would have resulted in protecting this child. The 5-year-old was beaten to death because he wet his pants. And it took them a little while to figure it out, but it turned out there was also a 7-year-old still in the house who had also been beaten but had not been killed. That was the daughter of Vonta McClellan, not India Kimball. India Kimball went on the run. Vonta McClellan was arrested and is being held on $500,000 bail. Does this happen all over the country? Does it happen all over the world? Most likely. But is this also something that happens as a result both of poverty, economic poverty, poverty of intellect, poverty of education, and poverty of spirit, if that's the right word? Yes. I anticipate that in the little pause, and I'm notorious for them, that I took after saying yes there, like 5 seconds worth, I anticipate that by the time that our buddy Scott in Sweden hears this, he'll be clacking away on the keyboard. Because, see, it's not legal to beat your kids in a place like Sweden. But in a place like Alabama, or Tennessee, or Georgia, or Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina, Kentucky, Mississippi, Louisiana, Oklahoma, Texas, Kansas, Missouri, Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, Nevada, God knows, Utah, Arizona, probably New Mexico, and big chunks of the states that we consider reasonably enlightened, if you bring up the notion that maybe we ought to have a law that you don't get to beat children anymore, even if they are your biological children or your foster children, there will come a great howl of complaint that the big government is trying to tell you how to raise your youngins. Because, see, the argument... I had the money, honest to Jesus, I would get in the car, I would drive down to Alabama with my little recorder, and I'd get some audio on this, and I'd play it back here. Or maybe I'd just go down the road, because it's not like West Virginia is that far different from Alabama-stan. Or anywhere in Appalachia-stan. Appalachia-stan extends into Alabama-stan. And ask people. Maybe down here at the Baptist Church, or maybe go visit the Methodists. And ask them whether or not we should have a law against beating children. There are still people who say, you know when our schools began to go bad? When they told them when they told the teachers they couldn't beat the children anymore. Because, see, and the reason I said Alabama is because this story comes out of Alabama-stan. The problem, and this is... Are you typing yet, Scott, sometime tomorrow? The problem here, if you ask your average Alabama-stanian, is not that the child was... Well, I mean, the problem is that the child was beaten to death. But the overarching problem is that they didn't beat the child the right way. With an additional problem being that they beat the child for the wrong thing. I mean, there's stuff you beat children for, and there's stuff you don't beat children for. And so it's not that we ought not be beating our children. I remember I was in the Atlanta airport. I was sitting there waiting for a plane to somewhere. And there was a story about children being beaten on Fox News. Or maybe it was CNN. It's Atlanta. It's the home of CNN. Maybe it wasn't Fox. And somebody, you know, some big old burly fellow with a, you know, one of those accents said, well, my daddy beat me all my life and I turned out to be a pretty doggone good human being. I don't see that beating was, and I think we even talked about this when I got back from wherever the hell I was going or coming from. And that attitude prevails. And I'll warrant that it probably also prevails in places like New Hampshire, parts of Massachusetts, certainly Michigan, Illinois, maybe Wisconsin. I'm damn sure that it probably prevails in South Dakota, North Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, the eastern parts of Oregon and Washington, certain portions of California, without a doubt in Arizona, probably in New Mexico, for absolute sure in Texas, since they allow foster children to be beaten to death. It's not that beating children is wrong. It's that there's a right way and a wrong way to beat children. And ever since they took prayer out of the schools and the paddlings, our society done gone to hell. This country, despite everything we are told, is still filthy rich. because we still get to print our own money. And the full and we make a pretty nice turn on a bond these days, even yet. Yet as wealthy as we are, we haven't yet figured out how to teach parents the right way to beat their children. Because obviously there's a right and a wrong way. And you know, if we say you can't beat your children, well, the next thing you know, you're on the mighty warm and toasty road to that hell known as Scandinavian socialism. Sometimes I really do. I try to put myself in a sort of imaginary space, a hypothetical space. And I imagine what it would be like if, and I know I'm talking particularly about Scott, but you know, this applies equally to Harry in Finland and Michael in Norway. Do we have any Danes in the, because I know we've got some Dutch. But if you can get past my accent and get the gist of what it is that I'm talking about, and you're sitting there in Scandinavia, in that socialist hell in which you live, are you just sitting there in goggle-eyed wonder? No, not wonder, horror. Of all the problems with which we have to contend in this country, probably one of the ones that we could get done with most easily is the notion of beating children to death. This is not complicated. This is not some monstrous economic problem. There are economic aspects to it. There are educational aspects to it. By God, there are religious aspects to it. But if some enlightened soul, and they really do exist, I promise you, in the legislature of the state of Alabama was to stand up and propose a law that said no one shall be beating their children anymore. Because see, that's proactive. That's not saying it shall be illegal to beat your child to death, because then the kid has to die before you can do something, or it shall be illegal to beat a child until the child is injured, because the child still gets injured. But rather, a proactive law that says it shall be illegal to beat your child. You know who'd be the first to march on Montgomery on goat heel? To oppose that bill? The Christians. The Christians who worship the itinerant rabbi Palestinian day laborer who said, "Suffer the children to come unto me." And something along the lines of, anyone that would hurt one of these, it should be better that that person had never been born. I think that's in there, isn't it? I try to forget, but I can't completely. The religion industry would bring out their multitudes, and they would preach fire and brimstone and damnation upon the enlightened legislator who said, "Let's not beat our children anymore." The white churches would do it. The black churches would do it. Oh, yes. Probably even the Latino churches would do it. Might be a moratorium on arresting illegal aliens just long enough to get them there to protest against not being able to beat children. Because God wants them beat. And perhaps even, and this much is probably strawmanning, perhaps even some enlightened liberals or progressives down there would say, "Well, I think we probably need to have a more measured response to this. By the way, happy birthday, Scott. Thank you for reminding me. I sent you a note earlier. They haven't decided yet, as of the publication of this story. They haven't decided whether to seek the death penalty against the parents. They haven't yet decided whether or not it's appropriate to kill these parents in the name of the state for the parents beating the child for wetting his pants. I've decided. But we got Alabama, we got Texas, but if we went looking around, it wouldn't be long before we found, well, good God, is it Oregon that has that bizarre sect? That likes to watch its children die while they pray them to death. Not beating them, just neglecting them. But at least they periodically prosecute those, again, after the child is dead. Because, you know, we can't outlaw their religion altogether, because that would violate the First Amendment. And the First Amendment ain't nothing but a life support system for the religion industry, any hoodle. So you get the idea. I think I'm all filibustered out at 22 minutes past the hour. We're still working on the other nine folks to kick in to meet Darlene's challenge for this evening. I certainly hope that happens. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's John. How you doing?
Hey, John, how are you?
Pretty good. Listen, I'm sorry to derail. I was sort of increasingly sheepish about what I wanted to call in about in light of what you're talking about.
No, don't feel bad.
Yeah. No, I know. I wanted to just say a couple of things about this Washington Post sale. I think it's really pretty important, and it also comes on the heels of the sale last week at the Boston Globe, or at least the announcement of it.
Right.
New York Times unloaded the Globe with a Red Sox owner for something like $75 million, which is astonishing.
I mean, okay, so it is. I mean, even $250 million, that's kind of fire sale prices, aren't they?
That's chump change. I cannot imagine the Post being, you know, that having any relationship to its actual value, let alone the Globe. I mean, the buildings and the properties themselves, the press has got to be worth, you know, more than $250 million. It's astonishing.
Stop. Wait a minute, John. I don't want to take you away from your thesis, but the press itself has got to be approaching that value?
Not the press by itself, but I mean the buildings and the land.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Press.
I mean, well, I mean, I happen to know where the Washington Post is in Washington, D.C., and there's no such thing as cheap downtown property.
Right, that's the physical building of that, but they have, you know, off-site printing, so they get this huge printing complex, too, and a huge building and land and rent. And I mean, the capital value itself has got to be incredibly, you know, close to that figure, let alone, you know, the people and the employees. But I think that there's a lot of really troubling things about this. I mean, Bezos isn't known. I guess my biggest problem is that he wouldn't buy this company because he wants to make the Post a better paper. And that's kind of the end of the story for me.
Because doesn't that open the inquiry up as to what the definition of a better paper is?
Yeah.
I mean, okay, I'm going to try not to make strange little woodland animal noises in this process, John, but if you're a guy who founded Amazon, where in there is any, do we know anything about Jeff Bezos that says, you know what, this guy's going to reshape journalism as we know it and reignite the fires of the Fourth Estate? Is there anything there?
No, he would certainly reshape and relight the fires of different things. I mean, what he knows about is reselling products very cheaply and efficiently by not paying folks, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, $13 an hour for a reporter, you know, roughly what they pay an Amazon, you know, one of the really good full-time Amazon warehouse workers.
Yeah, the Post, the newspaper division, just did some looking. First half of this year lost something like $50 million. Now, that is a bit misleading because a big chunk of that was sort of deferred pension obligations that they had to pay from previously. I don't understand the finance, but a big chunk of that was because they owed a lot of pension money that they hadn't paid before, so they paid it in the first half of this year. Now, what would Bezos think about the idea of pension payments, do you think?
I'm guessing he feels about that the way that certain people feel about plague and leprosy and.
Right. He doesn't know jack about pension payments. He doesn't believe in it because he doesn't do it at his company. I'm willing to be corrected on that, but I'm certain that the vast majority of the rank and file don't earn pensions working in Amazon warehouses.
I think that almost goes without saying. And frankly, John, the definition that we now have of pensions, i.e., a 401k scam, where—and I say scam—it's that's probably overbroad on my part—but the traditional pension that my father knew, after a lifetime dedicated to making molten metal pour out of a furnace, that's gone. It doesn't exist. And so, you know what. And by the way, I have to tell you, I just got a note in from Isaac saying that Bezos doesn't get the building either.
Oh, really? Oh, that's retained by the Post company, I guess?
Yeah, well, and they're retaining some other stuff, what is it, Finance World, or, no, Foreign Policy.
Yeah. Hey, from what I could tell, this was largely just the paper and its assets, or some of its assets. The Washington Post company, they own Kaplan, for instance. And
right.
That's staying with the company. They're going to have to rename it, I guess. This is the paper, which is I've got no particular love for the Grahams or whatever, but you know they at least understood news and they had some level of dedication to it. So when they owned it, that was at least part of the goal. You know, they know about this; they've been doing it for generations. That's not what Bezos brings to the table. What he brings to the table is knowledge of efficiency and cost cutting. And low wages, extracting profits. The newspaper business doesn't need more people that do that. We've got plenty of those people. They've got plenty of those people in positions of management in different newspaper companies. What he brings to the table isn't something new and revolutionary and good for journalism.
Is the Post a union shop, John? Do you know?
I don't know. I suspect it is. Simply because I used to work in Baltimore, and it is. But that doesn't directly...
Because, I mean, I'm wondering if $250 million buys you some union busting, too.
Well, yeah, I would like to know that. My suspicion it is, but is that it is, but I don't know that that's true.
And this I find interesting as well. I'm watching the chat room. That last union busting query came from Stockton Larry, but Lottie... one of our mods in the chat room says, we know this much. Bezos, 49, is considered a liberal, and since 2001 has donated only to Democrats, including a historic $2.5 million contribution to Washington United for Marriage, a pro same-sex marriage nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're moving around the kind of money that Jeff Bezos is moving around, liberal versus conservative takes on rather a fluid comparative meaning, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, I think it does, and that's well and good, and I'd rather have someone who donates like that than someone who donates like the Koch brothers. But the premise that I've got, basically, is just that what would make the Post a better newspaper is a better commitment to honest journalism, and that's not what this guy's going to bring.
I don't see how it can, but by the same token... I think we could also say gone are the days of, Woodward and Bernstein were kind of a one-off, weren't they? I mean, it wasn't in the history of the coverage of the Watergate break-in and the subsequent cover-up and the journalistic expose of it. Isn't there some evidence that it was a story that the Post tried, Ben Bradley at the time, tried really hard not to run?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And I, you know... I remember when he and Katherine Graham said during the midst of the Iran-Contra affair that the Post had decided, you know, not the people of the United States, but the Post had decided that Ronald Reagan did not need to be pursued because in their estimation the country could not stand another Watergate. And for me, that's one of those towering moments of epic fail.
Yeah.
For somebody like Bradley or Graham to say that they knew what the country could or could not stand.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly true. But with Watergate, with the Pentagon Papers, with the Pentagon Papers, and eventually with Iran-Contra, they got on board and they became a news leader, and they did it in part because of their historic back and forth competition with the New York Times.
Right.
You know, there's a big push for them to one up each other. They're competing for the best reporters, the best stories, the best scoops, the best access. Access is a little tricky. But that's what happens when you have, you know, good people working for you, a good reputation, a commitment to news, domestic and foreign, and being the political and sort of cultural tastemaker in the media. And to do that, you need people, and you need staff, and you need to value the craft of journalism, which is what, at least, again, in very broad strokes, newspaper family ownership has tended to bring to Washington and before then to New York.
Can I, if you know, John, can I ask you, if you get to be a full-on staff reporter, somebody, you know, who you know, you're no longer a cub or an apprentice or, you know,
yeah,
you're a journey person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What kind of money is that?
It's pretty good money, and if they are Newspaper Guild, I'm vaguely familiar, you know, fairly familiar with what the scale was when I was at a guild paper of a similar size. And a reporter that was, you know, on a beat, had a couple of years under his or her belt, would very easily be making in the neighborhood of $50,000-$60,000.
You know, that's decent money. It's not great money.
Not great money. And quickly, seniority would accumulate and would bump you up. You know, we're not talking $100,000, at least. Washington may be a little bit different from Baltimore, but when I was there, that was, you know, that was a good salary.
And because I just, well, if this, like the sale of the Globe, like the sale of the Plain Dealer, because that happened last week too, didn't it?
Yeah.
If these, all of these things seem predicated, and I just want to make sure that I've got my facts straight, are all of these models and these cuts that you described, the cuts take place in the newsroom, which is the heart and soul of why there's a newspaper in the first place, right? How do you wind up having a newspaper when you don't have any reporters? Do you just subscribe to the wire service and you put up a blog and wait for people just to post gossip on your website?
Yes.
Really? That was kind of a smart-ass statement on my part, but the answer is yes?
Yeah. No, it's actually true. I mean, especially with a sort of larger company, not so much like the Washington Post, because they only have a couple of papers, New York Times company, but somewhere like Gannett, the other really big newspaper company. You know, they got 81 newspapers in USA Today, and a lot of their small dailies will pick up stories from their sister papers or from USA Today and run them, you know, and wire serve it.
But what happens to the community? Where the news, and maybe I'm just sounding naive like this, but I mean, I'm 50 years old. I grew up watching my father, who was older at the time. I mean, I was the child of older parents, is what I'm getting at. But I'd watch my father come in, sit down in his easy chair and open the paper, and he would sit in one easy chair and my mother would sit in the other, and they'd swap sections of the paper and they'd talk back and forth to each other about what was going on in town, what was going on in the country. My mother would gamely try to participate in discussions of the box scores and the baseball standings, and it can you tell that it obviously had resonance for me? What happens when none of that's in the paper? I mean, what happens when you can't? One of the big sellers has always been the local sports pages, and you've got a beat writer who goes out and covers the high schools, and if there's a local university, those guys. Are they gone too?
Yeah, a lot of them are gone. Sports is, a lot of times there's a push to keep sports just because it is something that people read, you know, and they will have to have a staff. But a lot of sports departments are staffed largely by streamers and interns and people that in the community that they pay a very small wage to go out and sit at those high school football games and feed copy into the desk, and then they write the story, you know. And look at your whatever your community paper is, you know. It's probably largely wire copy, maybe not on the front page, but
well, I got to tell you, I'm kind of lucky in that we've got a little weekly over across the river here, but the paper that everybody reads in this region is either the Beckley paper or my preference, the Charleston paper, the Charleston Gazette. And it's still family-owned. And so they're still, whether you agree with them or disagree with them, they're still doing old-school newspapering.
Right.
So, I mean, that's why I wondered. I mean, I'm still a little bit spoiled here. I can go down, buy the newspaper in the morning, go through it, read it, you know. And I made this remark about books versus Kindles the other night. I feel the same way about newspapers. I can go through and check the online version, but there is a reality to holding the physical present, and maybe is that just because I'm older now? That I like the physical paper in my hands?
Well, I agree with you, but there's also a permanence to it that I think is important. Like I think it's important that cities have the newspaper box out there and people see it, and it's a presence, and there's people on the trains and in the coffee shops reading it. You know, that's valuable because it says that the paper isn't pooped out of a distribution center somewhere. It's made by actual people who live there and know what's going on. That's an important symbol. And as we shift more and more to online, what we lose is that institutional memory, the seasoned reporters, the people who treat this like a craft, because they're getting priced out, or they're getting laid off, or they're getting bought out, and they're bringing in 20-something who went to journalism school and learned things like how to write SEO headlines and how to, you know, crowdsource through social media, not how to go down to the courthouse every day, talk to the prosecutors, talk to the DAs, talk to the defense attorneys.
Yeah,
you know, shoe leather reporting.
Well, that being the case, I mean, and again, this is just all tied up with my own heritage. We got old family Bibles here,
yeah.
And we can save the digression on old family Bibles for later. But the old family Bible was where my grandmother, born in 1894, tucked the articles that she would clip from the newspaper for future generations. You know, me.
Wow.
And they're not of any particular. You know, there'll be a column by a guy. He was a preacher and a columnist over in Beckley, named Shirley Donnelly, and he wrote about the heritage of the region. And from time to time, he would write about people that wound up being related to me. And this stuff is in the Bible, and it's not in the Bible, but it's a clipping, and now it's as yellow and fragile and flaky as baked phyllo dough.
Yeah.
But Jesus, you hold that in your hand, John, and you can think about the old woman with her trembling hand and her scissors.
Yeah.
Clipping it out because something told her this was worth saving. Now, how do you do that? And maybe we've entered the Luddite portion of the program. How do you do that with a flash drive?
Well, that's astonishing. But how do you get people like her to engage with the newspaper when it is only digital, which is where things are going? You know, I've got a little bit of experience in this. But I worked for a short time at a paper here, and there was a big push to, you know, move things online, and subscriptions would get that, and lots of times the paper wouldn't come, and so people would call in and complain, and I'd say, well, I would have to say, well, if you go to our website, you can look at this. And the people, so many times, I would get calls, and they were obviously older people, and they would say, I don't have a computer. How am I supposed to read the paper? How am I supposed to see who died? How am I supposed to see what high school won?
Isn't this,
I don't have an answer for that.
Right, and isn't this along the same lines of the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Americans who will be disenfranchised from voting because we really do still have a generation of people who don't have a birth certificate, who do not have a driver's license, who have never seen a need for a driver's license, and are, well, the classic story being the 101-year-old lady in Pennsylvania who had no birth certificate and no driver's license, no means of getting one, and her congressman had to take her to voters registration and make them give her a voter ID.
Yeah.
And that only happened for her because the congressman stepped in. There were lots of other people who didn't get that treatment.
Yeah.
But it seems like somewhere along the way, the digital revolution is failing a whole lot of people. And is it just a matter of a certain generation saying, well, you know what, they're going to be dead soon anyway, it doesn't matter, and eventually we'll have everybody using the electric box?
Don't get me started about the age and class issues with the digital divide.
Well, I was kind of hoping
that's
to.
That is such a huge important issue, and I get so frustrated in some ways about this push to digitize everything, make everything open and online, because the assumption is that everyone is going to be able to access it. That is such a false assumption.
Well, there's a classist and ageist assumption in the definition of everyone.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was trying to say, is that everyone means a very circumscribed percentage of our population. They happen to be the ones who are the consumers that business chases. And so that's everyone. That's all that matters. And this is the same sort of issue with my complaint about Bezos and the paper, because, you know, what's good for everyone? What's good for journalism? Well, it's what's good for shareholders, and it's what's good for profit, but it's not what's good for the craft. What's good about digital, online, everything? Well, it's good for everyone. In other words, it's good for people who have money, who have internet access, and the hell with everybody else.
And see that... let me just expand this a little bit. Don't think for an instant that it does not bother me that, for instance, what we're doing here with the horn is a part of that discriminatory process.
Yeah.
I mean, I was glad, I was thrilled when things like the TuneIn app and the Stitcher app came out, and that meant that people could listen in their cars. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was part of the stranglehold that AM radio and the right wing had on other points of views' ability to get out and about. So that's pretty huge. But there have been determinations made that terrestrial radio, which for the cost of a radio you can get for free, almost free, electricity being electricity or batteries being batteries,
mm-hmm.
it is far more democratic, little de-democratic, I guess, than what I'm doing here in this conversation that we have worked so hard to foster over the years. Because you can't get this, and it's why net neutrality matters too, but you can't get this unless you're already paying for a computer, a smartphone, and some kind of bandwidth access, whether it's your cable provider, your phone provider, satellite, or your wireless cell phone provider. So it is most definitely undemocratic, and it's frustrating at times because I recognize the reality of trying to get into terrestrial radio, even though I kind of dog it from time to time. It's frustrating, John, because a lot of the people we would like to involve in the conversation are locked out. I mean, there are people who, when I left America's fifth smallest radio market, I was dead to them. Because they couldn't log on, they didn't have a computer, and, weren't gonna. And so, I think you're right. I mean, it's probably a topic for a larger conversation down the road that I hope we will have. But whether it's journalism or the franchise or media access, we got problems. We got big problems.
Yeah. Go on.
No, please.
I know you're frustrated by that, and you've talked before about the issue with the 800 number, for instance, and that's one means of access for a lot of folks, and I know that it's frustrating to you. But I think that there is a difference between what you are doing and what someone like, Bezos and media, because you're working in one of the few spaces that's left because the money guys have locked this out in so many ways. They've set up so many roadblocks that you come up with a creative way to get past some of those, and it's not perfect, and it's not as fully accessible, but that's the cost of trying to do the fight that you're doing. for media companies with all this money and all this clout, they don't really have an excuse for intentionally locking people out of the conversation, which is what they're doing.
How expensive is it, John, for a small market paper to print a daily?
Boy, that's a great question.
I mean, because I mean the economics. You know, my daily paper is, I think it's 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, because I'm easily baffled by numbers, and we all know that, I sit and I think, my God in heaven, how many 50 cents do you have to pay for the electricity to run the presses and the paper and the ink and the bona fide genius who knows how to make the press turn out a newspaper and the people who deliver it and the reporters and the subscription to the wire service and still wind up making a profit? Because, for instance, the Beckley paper is owned by a consortium out of Alabama that uses teachers' retirement money, or maybe they got out and the Utah people got in. But, you know, there was a consortium out of Alabama that used teachers' retirement money to buy newspapers.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, how can you do all those things and still provide enough of a return to make sure that that Mrs. Rutledge, who taught third grade for 40 years, still gets her retirement check?
Well, subscription sales are a very small percentage of revenue. In most places, newsstand sales, which are usually higher, are actually bigger than subscription sale revenues. But ad revenues are the big thing. That's the lion's share of newspaper revenues come from advertising, online, local, and national display. And that's the crunch, is that revenue has consistently been falling over the past decade or more. And so that's why there's so much of an issue. But I think maybe that's not the right question. Maybe the right question is, just to throw this out, why does journalism need to be profitable?
That was my next step.
Yeah.
And not profitable does not necessarily mean, we're not asking why won't people work for free.
Right.
We're asking, why does journalism have to be something that supports shareholders?
Well, shareholders who demand not just profits, but increased profits.
Right.
That's the issue. Newspaper companies are profitable, but they're not as much as they were the year before, or the year before, or the year before. And there's a diminishing sense there, and that makes Wall Street very unhappy. It's not enough to make money. You got to keep making more money.
It's almost, and ironically so, it's almost Stalinist in its approach, because, you know, the story where we were all told about the five-year plans on the collective farm, that, you know, you'll have this many bushels this year, and if you meet your quota, you know, you're rewarded by having your quota doubled next year.
Yeah.
And that's the Wall Street approach too.
Yeah, it's the Wall Street approach to everything. And so there's only so much money to go around, and there's only so much ways that you can increase revenue. And the solution so far has been to cut costs. And you can only do that so much, this is what you were asking, you can only do that so much and retain the kind of people who can deliver a product that meets some sort of standard. So that raises the question to me, why does journalism need to show a profit? There's a couple of ways around it. I mean, people like the Post Company, for instance, they have invested in other kinds of businesses in addition. You know, they had Newsweek for a while. They have Kaplan. They have several other things. And so while the Post may be losing money, the Washington Post Company had $5 billion in assets and has been in the black always. But you've got this one property, which is how they think about it. They don't think of it as the Washington Post. They don't think about it as the thing that helped break the Pentagon Papers. It's a property, and it is losing money, and it's going to keep losing money, and so we have to unload it. What I would love to see is some sort of co-op approach to journalism.
Yeah.
You see elements of that, you know, but...
Or a 501c3.
A non-profit sort of model that could work as well, or a model like in, with some things at least in Britain, you know, why does broadcasting have to be a for-profit business? Why can't it be run by an arm of the government.
You know, in many ways, it's reminiscent of the NFL. You know, you've got the Packers up there in Green Bay, who are not run on a for-profit basis,
right,
and have remained wildly successful over the years, and probably if they went on the market, would be the most lucrative sale of a football franchise in history. But the one thing the NFL did after that was, okay, that's fine for Green Bay. Nobody else gets to do that.
Yeah, nobody else does.
Has anybody stepped up and thought about that model, John?
I'm sure people have thought about it. I don't know that it's in practice anywhere really large, but I said that there's no reason that a group of journalists and PR types and ad folks and distribution guys couldn't come together in a co-op and attempt to buy or start a paper. There's nothing stopping them except, of course, money. But
there's nothing out there to suggest that somehow or another this would be doomed to failure. I read an article the other day, and this may seem wildly off topic, John, but I read an article about the Publix grocery stores. Coming up out of Florida. And it was, you know, Publix, the Walmart killer.
Hmm.
And it's employee-owned, and I think the owner of Publix, and probably geography has something to do with this, but the man who founded Publix was the first person to put couches and air conditioning in his grocery stores so that people could have a little bit of, you know, a more decent experience. But, I mean, the only thing I can imagine that would stand in the way, newspapers love to endorse candidates at election time, right?
Sure.
Most nonprofit rules, and they're the same rules that keep the John Hagees of the world technically from being able to endorse candidates, prevent other nonprofits from doing the same.
Right.
And so that would kind of have to be figured out. But I don't think that's anything like coming up with a unified field theory or, a craft that can go faster than light. Physics and the laws of nature do not preclude it.
Right, and simple public ownership doesn't necessarily mean that a media outlet would be real cozy with the government. I mean, look at PBS, look at Jim Lehrer. I mean, you know, that's. Nobody would accuse them of being shills for American policy. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be like that. I mean, I think you could have a watchdog role in public ownership, and I don't think that those conflict necessarily. So, yeah, these issues could be solved.
Sandra just shot me a note via Twitter. She says, "No, Bob, it's back to Citizen Kane," talking about the Washington Post.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. So,
well, I don't either, but I'd like to see what happens. It would be nice if somebody could try that experiment and succeed, because the fundamental problem we have is that the digital divide is a blessing and a curse at the same time, because you want people to access your stuff online, but then you realize that you're getting killed in your ad sales because nobody's buying your paper. And everybody's reading it online, so the only response that Wall Street has is, "My God, we'll put up a paywall."
Yeah.
And that's no answer either, is it?
Well, the Post revenues have been online revenues have been up since the paywall came in, so people are willing to pay for it. But they're willing to pay for it because they still, at least for the foreseeable future, have some decent journalists working and people who are doing good reporting. If the cost-cutting model, you know, keeps driving people out and we start hiring in people right out of college at $13 an hour, if they're lucky, on the Amazon model, that's not going to last. I just don't see that it can. I don't see that you can have a First Amendment watchdog role and also serve shareholders at the same time. To me, it seems that's a fundamental opposition to me. What do I know? I'm just a grumpy young lefty.
Yeah, but you do it so well.
I try. Thanks a lot for giving me a chance to vent, okay?
Oh, no worries, John. Thanks for chiming in. I really, really appreciate it. A wonderful conversation.
All right, my pleasure. Talk to you about it later.
See you, John. Bye. That's Dr. John. And, there was, everybody has their fan. Yeah, that's one of the things I love about this little undertaking is that within the community, such as it is that we've built together, I have built nothing. Y'all have done the heavy lifting. Everybody has their favorites, and I was noticing a comment in the chat room while we were talking with one of the chatters saying, "Dr. John's my favorite." And you know, all of you who call in have a fan club. Sandra's got a fan club. Dr. John's got a fan club. Bill has a fan club. Tracy has a fan club. Jim has a fan club. It's it goes on and on and on. And, well, I don't know many other places where that kind of thing is happening, and I find it inspiring. By the way, I'm going right back to the phone, so please stick around if you're on hold. Thanks to Beth. She's gotten in on Darlene's challenge for this evening, which means we are now only seven folks away from meeting Darlene's challenge, which is a big, big, big deal, because it'll go a long way toward getting us out of the hole and make it maybe easier to get out of the hole, all the way out of the hole tomorrow. We need seven folks, $10 apiece. And, well, you heard the conversation with John. I mean, there are larger issues at work here. And one of those is it possible? Because even ad revenues in a newspaper, and as quickly as John was answering my question with ad revenues are a big part of it, Randy in PA was saying, "Well, you know, Bob, it's 50 cents plus the revenue from advertising." And that's true. The problem with advertising is that it transforms whatever medium one is talking about from a vehicle of information into a vehicle for delivering, and television and radio are far worse about this than print media are. But it transforms the medium from being a vehicle for the transmission of information into a vehicle for the delivery of consumers into the waiting arms and tender mercies of various and sundry sorts of advertisers, whether it be Buy Gold Now or Wave Radio or free car wash with fill up at Freddy's Shell on Fridays. And in that transformation, lots of things can go wrong, and I think many more. I mean, you know, a few things can go right. In other words, things stay afloat, but a lot more things can go wrong, such as the medium in question loses, for want of a better term, its soul, or winds up getting bought out by Amazon, or the guy who owns Amazon. That's the big deal. Amazon didn't buy the Washington Post. Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post. It's going to be Jeff's baby, and the Amazon board can go pound sand because they don't know anything about journalism. Don't know if Jeff Bezos does, but yeah, maybe he'll learn on the job. Hey, thank you very much, Karen. Thank you very kindly. We're getting there. Only six folks at $10 apiece to go to meet Darlene's challenge. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program. No? Hey, welcome aboard.
Ah, you're talking to me.
Hey, Bill, what's happening?
Well, Bob, I got a quick story to finish up with, and I'll go on to what you've been talking about. I asked you about Tsingtao. Well, the Germans pulled their two cruisers and four other ships out, and those guys sailed all the way to South America, picking up coal all the way. That's what you think about that logistics.
Oh, yeah.
You know, those were all coal-fired steamships. Anyway, they beat the British off the west coast of South America, and then they sailed over to the Falklands. And what they didn't, because they were going to destroy the radio stuff down there. Look at that British possession, as we learned how many years ago when the Argentinians and British fought a small war over that.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, to make a long story short, they lost, and they lost all their Pacific ships went down. But here's the thing. What chased them out of Tsingtao, was it the English? Was it the French? Was it the Russian fleet? No, it was the Japanese. They jumped in. I forgot the small part where they fought on the Allied side, slightly, little bits in World War One. But they also, they picked up the Marianas, and among other things, the Marianas and the Solomons. And, of course, you know when I say Solomons, there's a place where the U.S. Marines went in 42 on a very unpleasant trip.
Yeah, Guadalcanal.
Guadalcanal, right. I said, this is how this stuff, you know, this history is like a revolving door. Somebody goes through it and pushes somebody else out of the way, and now they're there.
Wasn't Guadalcanal where MacArthur earned the nickname Dugout Doug?
No, that was the Philippines. That's was when it? He was. He spent most of his time on Corregidor. Well,
Corregidor.
Well, Wainwright. When Wainwright, you know, Roosevelt pulled him out by PT boat and plane to Australia. MacArthur.
Right.
And Wainwright was stuck dealing with it. And Wainwright was a guy who. When he was commanding one half of the Philippine forces, he was visiting his men every day. And, you know, compared to Doug, who didn't come off of... he was brave enough, MacArthur, but he was not a good... he wasn't the kind of leader that was up there in front talking to his men and trying to... Men who were already on 2,000 calories a day, by the way, because the logistics people didn't ship enough food into... not Corregidor, the peninsula, Bataan.
Yeah.
They were supposed to have tons of food there. Those guys were fighting a war on 2,000 calories a day in subtropical climate almost from the beginning. And then when they did have to surrender, what was it, in April? April. I think it was the same day Lee surrendered, April 9th, the same date. April 9th, Lee surrendered in 65, these guys in 42, and that's when, of course, I've read several books on the Death March, and I don't have a lot of regard for the Japanese Army. Well, between that and what they did in China, well, Nanking, for instance, they were real, talk about Nazis, and hell, the Japanese even had a medical thing going on in Manchuria. Like Mengele had going on in Europe, you know. Anyway, that's another story. But you got me tonight when you start talking the stuff about child abuse. I spent 4 years in a Catholic children's place because of illnesses my mother had, and I went out there a straight A student and came out hating school and angry as hell about everything and fight. You know, the only thing people say, what'd you learn out there? Well, I learned a little clarinet and learned how to play baseball and football, which was enjoyable. I said the rest of it. Remember a nun, you know, you saw the movie The Blues Brothers and how those nuns acted toward the
fellows.
Well, that wasn't very funny when it was being done to us constantly. Because that place opened in 25 as an orphanage, which is another thing people don't get. Most people in this country do not realize how long people lived and how unhealthy they were in the States in the 20s, in the big cities and everywhere else, you know. I'm sure you do because, you know, back in the country, there were probably fewer doctors. Hell, they might have been. I sometimes think they were better in some ways than the ones we have today. They just didn't know as much or have as much facilities, but, you know. That's another story, but I saw this kind of brutality. We had one kid in that cottage who was he'd get angry and he'd back into a corner and bite himself up. And the kid was obviously by what I know today, he was a psychological problem, you know, not just behavior. But
I went to elementary school with a kid like that.
You'll see him, you know, and nobody knew what to do. I remember a nun slapping me back and forth. I'm about 11 years old, and she's slapping me back and forth across the face. And, Bob, I'm looking at her rimless glasses and measuring the distance between my left hand and her eyes. It's a wonder I just didn't smash her into her face because I had a temper as a kid. I did as an adult, too, for that matter, but... And anyway, the way they had all these little psychological games they'd play with you, and you know, luckily for us, I'll say one thing for that place, the priests we had were never chasing kids around, so they were, like my dad had a friend who used to come hear my dad's band play when in the 30s and 40s, and when this guy would come up dressed in street clothes, and he'd meet some young woman or other in the club and leave with him. Now, quite honestly, I would say I'd go along with that any time other than molesting children. It sure beats the hell out of it, you know. I can understand that. I can understand a man having an affair with a grown woman. My God, you know.
Yeah. Sold a bunch of books. Thorn birds.
Yeah. And then the other thing you hit tonight is the newspapers. There were three dailies here. The Cleveland News was an afternoon. The Cleveland Press was an afternoon. And that was the press editor was a guy named Louis B. Seltzer, who was worth looking up. Because he had a history of, I think he won, he might have won a Pulitzer. And then the Plain Dealer, which just this week is cutting back to, I think, publishing 3 days a week or 4 days a week. Because, you know, I don't...
Bill, I'm curious to find out, especially curious vis-a-vis younger listeners. Is my wistfulness for the days, and I'm not trying to talk about any sort of Ozzie and Harriet pipe and slippers routine, but, you know, the time one took, and when my, you know, I've talked about how my dad did rotating shifts, but I especially remember him getting home when he worked so-called day shift, 8 to 4.
Yep.
You know, he'd be in the door about 5:30. In Central Time, the local news comes on at 6. And so he'd be sitting there having dinner. Local news would be on. You know, the living room, you know, ranch-style, you know, mid-century, upward, you know, up-moving middle-class kind of home where the living and dining room were just one long space and a hallway in the bedrooms and the bathroom and the kitchen in the back. Ranch style, I think, was the term that was used. So Dad would sit there and read his paper, or he'd watch the news and then read the paper if it was day shift after dinner. And I do not know if there is, because there was an investment both of time in quantity and time in quality in that process. And I don't, and as someone who reads a boatload of stuff on the internet every day, I don't know if that has that same quality. For this reason, Bill, because if I sit and I see something that grabs my interest, I can't have that same relationship with my family that my dad had, where chuckling or horrified or whatever he was, he would take the paper, fold it over to the story he wanted, and he'd pass it over to Mom. And Mom would pass it over to me.
Yep.
Well, in 2013, everybody has to come and stare at the electric box screen.
Yep. And they hire people. Who did I hear today? This guy, Varney. Well, you were playing.
Yeah.
Hey. And I thought to myself, why in the hell don't you go back to England, you son of a bitch? I thought we got rid of you bastards.
They won't have him. Now, let's take it easy on the U.K. I mean, we got friends over there, Bill.
Paper. Buddies of mine shipped me stuff out of the, what is that English
newspaper? The Guardian?
Guardian, yes. Yeah, I get a lot of stuff emailed to me from the Guardian. There's a lot of stuff there. It's surprising what you keep learning. I made friends with a guy up here who's Ukrainian, and man, did I learn about the little event that Stalin pulled in the early 30s. A famine. Starved him.
Yeah.
You know, these things are... One of my best friends taught American history, and he said, Bill, he's watched the teaching of American history get weaker and weaker. In fact, he taught two of the kids that were the state rep, the one that quit a short time ago. Out of Lake County and that part of Ohio, he had been a prosecutor, and he won a big case against some Mormon who wiped out a whole family up in Sheridan one time, 10-12 years ago, and he ran for the House, and I forget what his name, but he was a pretty pretty decent Republican because he had a working side to him because of the amount of organized labor in his district. You know, and he quit. He left this year. La Tourette. He gave up the job. I think he had had it with these people that were part of his party. They had gone to a part. In fact, he prosecuted a guy, the son of a guy I know who killed a person. It's one thing about the bar business, Bob. You meet all kinds, you know.
Yeah, you do that.
They come through the door. In fact, that Euclid Tavern where I played 20 plus years, that place was sold to Case, and it's going to be torn down. That bar has been open since before the turn of the 19th to 20th century. But up there now, the school owns everything. That started when I was first hanging out in University Circle at 18. That was 1961. I mean, there were so many independent businesses, and now everything's owned by either the school or the hospitals. Because that's who has the money. When I went back up to play in that neighborhood within the last 5 years, most of the students that I saw and talked to were Asian kids, nice kids, Indians and Chinese kids. They were fascinated by American blues, you know, that got their attention. But so it's not a personal thing. It's a fact that Case Western Reserve costs so damn much money to go to. They used to produce some of the best doctors and the best engineers. Case was an engineering school, and those guys knew their stuff. I'd start talking electronics with a few of them because of the TV repair training that I had, and I felt illiterate after about 5 minutes with those guys. You know, they just knew so much. It's unbelievable. But you just, you know, when I talked about the chips that came out of Tsing Tao, and the Japanese end up with all these colonies in Asia, and, you know, it's like the stuff, the mess keeps going around. And the lack of newspapers, when I'd go out to fish for a week or two, I'd buy the Toronto newspaper just to have something to read when I was having lunch. Because, my God, how much could I talk to my wife when we're sitting in a boat for hours on end? We talk plenty, you know. So it was just, let me get a touch on what's going on. And the Canadian newspapers were interesting. And yeah, I read the USA Today. It was the only time I did because it was all the news that fits they print, you know?
Right.
Kind of deal. But yeah, I have a bad, you know, I've had my problems with reading. And reading was when I took the one college entrance test, I was in the upper 10% in reading and comprehension. And should have sold cars for Christ's sake instead of music. But anyway, if you
I saw
a lot of musicians who were car salesmen. That was a great way to hand out business cards. You hand them out in the
park. And the lot usually closed before you had to get to the gig. So
yeah, that's true too. I mean, the idea was. With me, I was like my old man, his generation. Get rich playing music? Hell no. Make a living doing something you love? Hell yes. That was the difference between the guys in the 30s and 40s. And hell, a lot of the guys in Chicago, I went up to Chicago in 67. Place on the south side had Sunday night jam session, a place called Pepper's Lounge. Well, that's where old McKinley Morganfield, a.k.a. Muddy Waters, used to play there when he was home in Chicago. And I think I sent you that thing about the little movie that's coming out that covers the white Chicago kids going down to hang out with Muddy and those guys and learn how to play this stuff.
Right.
That's the way cultural interchange is a good thing, you know. And, if you go back to 1920, King Oliver with Louis Armstrong and his band playing on the south side. If you look close, you might see a little slight white kid with glasses named Benjamin Goodman. And he's standing there listening to Johnny Dodds play clarinet. Because this is how culture is passed through by people knowing other people and learning from other people. And I don't care whether it's music or sports. Whatever, you know, I mean, you talk about newspaper, when Modell fired Paul Brown, It was the coldest winter I can remember as a young kid, and I think it was 62 when there was a newspaper strike. And a lot of us never forgave Mr. Modell for that little move. Yeah, wait till there's a newspaper strike and then fire a coach that had such a winning record it wasn't even funny. Well, most people can't go back far enough that Brown won the Eastern Conference title 50 through 55 and then back again in 57. I mean, that's a tremendous... they did a thing, I caught a show on football coaches, and I think they made him number 9, but I think he was better than that. Well, hell, he actually finished ahead of the guy that coached Dallas. What was his name, the early Dallas coach?
Oh, Landry?
Landry. And Landry and the magnificent Green Bay coach, I'm getting senile.
What, Lombardi?
Lombardi. They were assistant coaches with the Giants all through the 50s, trying to catch Paul. I think Landry was the guy who developed what was called the umbrella defense for anti-pass defense.
Yeah.
I mean, if you how did I learn all this stuff? You read newspapers. What I say, I'm still bitching inside about the woman I told you I'd call and out the news and talking about a Pomatox. I said, where the hell did she go to high school? Jesus, God. How dumb.
A Pomatox on all your houses.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you and I have, I'll say this, you and I have somewhat the same feelings about the leaders of the rebellion. A few of them should have been maybe tree decorators, I don't know. When you have 600,000 casualties out of 30 million population, and I know the Southern man fought with extreme bravery, as did the Northern soldiers, a whole bunch of them did. I mean, because if you know anything about the weaponry and how the field artillery had developed to a point, did you see the movie Gettysburg?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
That had some of the best, gave me some of my vision was still fine in those days, and I said, my God, when you see this stuff in, because one thing about the reenactors, I may think they're a little touched. Anybody walking around in the middle of June wearing a woolen uniform,
Because they're not making that. I mean, I'm not going to say they're not making that stuff out of microfiber yet, but no self-respecting reenactor would be caught in it.
Oh no, you had to buy the right stuff. You buy that 58 caliber Enfield or Springfield, and a uniform, and bless them, because at least somebody knows something. Like most Americans have no concept of what we did in World War One and why we got in it. And
I've been thinking more and more, not just why we got in it, but whether we should have gotten in it.
This is a theory that a lot of historians that I have bumped into in the course of reading say the same thing. Maybe it's letting those guys, the traditional European, battle it out to a standstill.
I was thinking just the other day, Bill, about the fact that, it's 2013, and if you go back and you read the history, you know that things were beginning to get warm by 1913.
Oh, yeah.
And then by about this time next year, 100 years ago,
yes, sir,
they'd gone from warm to blazing hot.
Well, I picked up a book in the first grade, and it opens up, I think...
And remember, the von Schlieffen plan...
Yep.
Had been in existence and,
that had been since before 1900, that plan, I think.
Right, and the French response that, we will defeat the Germans with Kron.
Yeah, we will attack them with Elan, yeah.
Yeah. Was it Kron or Elan? Well, maybe it was both, I don't know.
Elan was, E-L-A-N, was a common French word for battlefield courage, I guess.
Yeah, and then Kron meant something else.
Yeah, what was the deal with the Schlieffen plan? The last German in line was to brush the North Sea with his...
Let the last man on the left brush the English Channel with his sleeve.
Well, it would have been the right, Bob.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why...
Well, not, no. Was it the right?
Oh, yeah. If you go from the English...
Well, yeah. If you're standing behind the... Yeah, then the German right, it would be the French left.
You're heading west. And then And then, of course...
So we know it's also not just math that I'm no good on the fly. It's also directions.
Well, I'm not good in directions sometimes. I could never find my way home after a job. That got me in trouble in my first marriage, a lot of it. And that was one of the biggest mistakes I ever made in my life, too, that's for sure. But I made my share. But anyway, to make a long story short, yeah, the Germans decided to go through Belgium, and theoretically that's what brought the English in because of the treaties that were signed after the Napoleonic Wars to guarantee Belgian neutrality. What even more interesting was what Adolf's people did in Tork, coming through the Ardennes forest and hills with tanks, and nobody thought they could do it. So much for that idea, too. In fact, Hitler tried that again in what became the Battle of the Bulge. It was basically the same maneuver.
Yeah.
Separate the English from the Americans and try to drive all the way to the English Channel. The Germans in 1944 didn't have enough goddamn gas to get to the English Channel.
Nope.
It's like my grandmother. I'll let you go after this. My grandmother, who was born in Germany and came here maybe around 1900 or so, and a lot of the words... The story of the Holocaust did not get out in this country till after the war. A lot of it was kept hidden, kept secret. And my mother said my grandmother would read this stuff and just sit and cry and say, what the hell happened to the country that I left in 1900? Where there was, anti-Semitism, anti-this guy, anti-that guy. You'll find undercurrents of that anywhere you go. I mean, you'll find undercurrents of... There was anti-Catholicism in this country. Why do you think Maryland was settled by mostly Catholics?
Right, Lord Calvert, sure.
It was...
Lord Calvert had a... Well, the Calvert family had a dispute with the Penn family over where exactly the dividing line for Pennsylvania and Maryland would be.
And that's the Mason...
And that's the Mason-Dixon line, and it's also how you wind up with Delaware... And what it was is the Calverts had designs on Philly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I know the Calverts, they used to brew pretty good booze or something, distilled, wasn't it, Calverts?
Yeah, oh yeah. But
anyway, I'll let you go because there's other people. But when I listen to the professor, it's like this history is like an endless wheel. It just keeps, the same stuff keeps popping up. But I feel the newspaper thing is just because... You'd be surprised how many people in my own age group can't read for shit. You know, when you ask them a question and you say, it's in this, I'll say, well, get this book. Oh, I don't read. Okay. You're sure missing a lot. That's
Well, and there's a difference between I don't read, I can't read, and I won't read. Quite often, I don't read equates to I won't read.
I won't. Well, and you and I know, we talked about that one night just recently. You go back and read the great crime novels, the great so-called detective writers, and there is so much sociology buried there.
Absolutely, Bill, but let me throw something in there since we've also been talking about newspapers, and that is this. I think I mentioned that back for Christmas, a friend of mine, a neighbor, it was for his birthday, his daughter bought him a replica newspaper, and I know that sounds a little crazy. But what it was, because he's a big West Virginia University Mountaineer fan, and it was a replica newspaper produced by the New York Times of 100 years worth of New York Times sports reporting on the West Virginia University Mountaineers, be it football, baseball, or basketball.
Wow.
And I being also a fan, thumbed through it. We laid it out on the pool table so that I wouldn't damage it or anything. And some of it was in extremely small print. Like, the print was considerably smaller in the older days of the newspaper, probably for reasons relating to printing cost and maximizing column inch space. But what blew me away was the reporting up through the 1940s. It's not that it was in just a different kind of English. I mean, for instance, if you sit down to read Mark Twain, Sam Clemens.
Oh, yeah.
You're reading a different kind of American Victorian English.
Yeah.
And he was, without a doubt, the master of it. You got him and Henry James and William James and William Dean Howells. And he and Howells were great friends, Twain was. But that's a Victorian kind of English.
Yes, it is.
But to read the journalism English, and this was professional journalism, that was, I would say, it's probably too strong a word, but I'll use it anyway. It was good written journalism English that had obviously been accompanied by ruthless editorial work. This is not to say that it was that the copy started out bad. It probably started out just fine, but you could tell from story to story to story that it was subjected to a certain style that made it rich. And by rich, I mean just crammed with detail, beautiful linguistic color.
Yes.
And I dare and defy anyone to pick up a newspaper and find that English.
No, you won't.
And I want to be really careful about saying stuff like this, Bill, because I don't want to channel my inner geezer or my inner codger, but it was not the stilted Victorian English that Twain and Howells and had to work in. It was not that English. It was a new modern kind, and I suppose you could say that you see the distillation and the paring down of that in the early stuff from Hemingway.
Yes, sir.
When you get down to Manuel drank his brandy, and the really spare kind of writing there. But I did. If most of the writing for public consumption today is being done on a 6th to 8th grade level, because that's what I've been given to understand as the fact, then that stuff from that era would be at least 12th grade, if not college level today. And I think there's something telling in that. I wish I had an example of it here, because I'd share it just so people could get a sense of it. But it's not Elizabethan English. It's not Victorian English. I mean, and I will mark myself for the Philistine that I am when I say this, but I'd kind of rather take a whipping than sit down with Dickens on any given day.
Now that's another story, that children's brutality. Oh God.
That's probably a bad analogy to use right now.
Hard because of what you talked about earlier.
But Charles Dickens wrote brilliantly and opened the eyes of the world to the abuses. Frankly, I think you can argue that Charles Dickens did as much to open the eyes of the world to the abuses rampant in Industrial Revolution England's capitalism,
yep,
as Marx or Engels ever did.
Yes.
Right down to A Christmas Carol. But Lord God, is it a chore to read sometimes?
Well,
I'm a pretty accomplished reader.
Well, this guy, Fletcher Pratt, who did this book, was originally titled Ordeal by Fire, and then it came out A Short History of the Civil War. One chapter was titled The Diathram of Sheba. You got any idea what the hell he was talking about? I mean, he talked about Krakatoa.
Yeah.
I mean, if I said Krakatoa to somebody, there was a woman, she'd probably slap me, thinking I said...
Nah.
What the hell?
The guy in front of the microphone can never be fully suppressed.
Yeah, well, anyway.
That sounds like it'd work on Friday night behind the chicken wire in a dive.
Well, we worked some funny places. What was fun for us, young Caucasian kids, was to go in and play with some older black guys. And here we are at 23, 24, and we're playing in the middle of what's the term they use today? Urban areas.
Yes, urban, urban.
Urban, yes. And I think a lot of the folks were real friendly and just, how did you learn to do that? And, well, I could have asked them how did a man that looked like them learn how to do, Anglo-Saxon things. Because it's there and we learn it, And if you have any I mean, hell, because this is what it amounts to. People of, I don't care what they look like or where they come from, they will learn what is there and they'll do something with it if somebody lets them. And we know where I'm going there because, I mean, it's so hard for a lot of kids to understand. My second wife, they'd go to Florida, and there was an old black man who was thirsty. And she brought him out a cup of water, and people looked at her like she was a criminal. I don't have to tell you that stuff because you know about it. But some, I don't think kids today would understand that, some of them, depending on where they grew up and how they grew up. I mean, that was insanity at its finest. And did anybody could be that ridiculously shitty? But anyway, I'll let you go, my friend. There's other people waiting at the yak, and I've done enough time tonight. Take care.
All right, Bill. You have a good night.
Good night.
Bye now. And I want to go. I want to go back to the I call it violence. Some, I suppose, would call it, you know, discipline. Spare the rod and spoil a child. I want to go back to that in a minute, but before I do, just a quick little addendum. I ran across something over the weekend. You remember my remarks Thursday about the difference between millennium and millenniums and millennia? Well, goddess of irony, hard at work. It's just in the little things. I ran across a story in the Mail Online out of the UK, and it's actually an older story. It goes back to the 25th of May, 2012. I'm always a sucker for old photographs. And how the Wild West really looked. Gorgeous sepia-tinted pictures show the landscape as it was charted for the very first time. And it's beautiful. These are beautiful photographs. Amazing. And it tells a pretty stunning story of the man who shot these photos, a man named O'Sullivan. But I go down and I look through the Twin Buttes near Green River City, Wyoming, pictures of Native peoples in their ordinary dress of the day, having been affected by white culture. Little towns sitting on broad expanses of nothingness. And then I ran across a picture of a mission church. It is in particular the old mission church, Zuni Pueblo, New Mexico, photograph taken in 1873. In fact, the caption to the photo reads, Old Mission Church, Zuni Pueblo, New Mexico, pictured in 1873, where the Zuni people of the north have lived for millennia. See? Now, this is a UK paper. And I guess that the Mail Online is willing to make certain presumptions about its readership that its readers know the difference between millennium and millennia. Along the lines of what I was talking with Bill about, you can make the New York Times is no longer willing to make such a presumption about the American reader. We have to say millenniums now, because Latinates are past us. A few minutes ago, actually a couple of hours ago, I guess, Texas Betsy wrote something. In my question, in the story about the Fox Goobs, and the guy who isn't Ducey or the Attack Blonde or Stuart Fulani, saying, well, what about being proud of not taking food stamps? And Texas Betsy wrote, good grief. Do they want to put the 90-year-olds back on the assembly line or air traffic control? And that, too, fed into something that I had seen over the weekend. There are a lot of back roads and byways, well, anywhere you live. But in this area where I live, the back roads and byways are often dotted with historical markers. And I am notorious for reading them. Oh, I'm an absolute sucker for him. And we were traveling a road, and I passed a historic marker, and it said Leyland, L-A-Y-L-A-N-D, mine disaster. Ferg was with me, so I had to make sure that we took in that information. Because if you can just catch the name, now you can go on the internet, see, there we are again, and find out from place to place to place what the copy is on a historical marker, where before you just blew right past it, and, well, that's that much more you didn't know. Well, we looked up a Leyland mine disaster. What a horror. 1915. We're not in the First World War yet. But coal production in this region was going hand over fist. There was no union. The working conditions and the working hours and the rates of pay were nothing if not brutal. And these places were spots on the road, but they turned into boom towns. Now there's hardly anything there except a historical marker and a church that in 2013 is still trying to raise up enough money to build a memorial for the Leyland mine disaster, because one's never been put up. You can drive down Route 3 out of Beckley, headed toward Glendaniel, and you'll pass a historical marker that says Eccles mine disaster. You're right. Sparky says you're vortex jumping, Bob. Apparently so. Can't be helped. No, Randy, I said 1915. 1915. It's that accent problem again. But I was reminded of what I read when I saw Betsy's remark about, you know, they want the 90-year-olds to go back onto the assembly line or air traffic control. In 1915, the New River and Pocahontas Consolidated Coal Company operated a series of drift mines at Leyland, Fayette County, 8 railroad miles north of Quinnamont. The whole area along the New River now is just ghost towns. More or less. I mean, there are a few houses here and there. So, I mean, isolated places where people have houses. But, well, not too far from here, there's a really bad pizza place. Oh, God, it's terrible pizza. But they have old photographs on their wall, and there's one photograph. And once you understand context, you know that it has to be pre-1913. And it's of three men standing in what appear to be a bar. They're done up in that early 20th century gear, that kind of suit. But you know that they're in a boom town because their shoes are dirty. They have a little bit of mud caked on them. There's a bartender behind the bar with the white apron on. Liquor bottles line the wall. There's a couple of pieces of late 19th, early 20th century pornography hanging above the bar. You know, those Rubenesque naked women. And probably the logo for some beer company. The men are holding shots of something, probably whiskey. One of them at least has his hat on. And there's just something, well, it's a moment forever frozen in time. And since they're holding liquor, you know that it's before 1913, because that's when Prohibition took hold in West Virginia, I believe. Somewhere around in there. well before. Yeah, you get to. Because state prohibition came before national prohibition. And they're looking at you out of the past. And you have, if you have any fascination with the past and with history, you cannot help but look back. And that photo had to be set up, and there's some blurred spots because somebody moved an iota, moved just a fraction of a second, and it blurred the photograph because it was still a plate with the, and a tripod, and, right. And so I talked to the manager of the place. Nice person. It's not her fault the pizza sucks. It's a chain. And she said, "Oh yeah, I know where that is. That's the old Winona pool hall. Winona. It's the old Winona pool hall." I said, "Well, I'll be darned." And I went home and started looking around. Lo and behold, as of 2012, I found a report online that the old Winona pool hall, a portion of it had just collapsed, but it was a going concern until 5, 10, 15 years ago. The old bar and the Victorian beer hall pornography were gone, and it was all gone. But it's one of those things that sprung up as a result of a coal town springing up. But back to Leyland. But you can extrapolate that one of those was in every one of these little burgs. In 1915, the New River and Pocahontas Consolidated Coal Company operated a series of drift mines. And a drift mine means that you walked in. It wasn't a shaft that went down into the earth. It went into the mountain, basically level with the coal seam. And it followed the coal seam. Operated a series of drift mines at Leyland, Fayette County, 8 railroad miles north of Quinnamon. At 8:30 a.m. March the 2nd, a blast swept through Leyland No. 3 mine, killing 112 men. The explosion blew out the drift mouth and struck dead a grocery delivery man walking nearby. Imagine the force of that blast. 7 survivors exited the mine shortly after the explosion, giving hope to the gathering crowds that others might be alive. Rescuers recovered several bodies during the next 3 days, and on March the 6th, 5 more survivors escaped the mine. These men had barricaded themselves from the afterdamp, and rescuers learned from them that 41 men had done the same deeper in the mine. They hurriedly entered the mine and located a famished group of survivors. Fearing the worst, some of these miners had scribbled short notes to their loved ones. Controversy surrounded the Leyland disaster. When the Secretary of the Interior suggested gold medals for federal rescuers, state officials and local volunteers questioned the contribution of the federal team, and some individuals insisted that the trapped miners had been saved by their own wisdom. Federal representatives using the latest methods determined that the disaster resulted from the ignition of methane propagated by coal dust, but state officials insisted that careless blasting of a coal face produced the explosion. That kind of argument proceeds to this day. 29 men, nearly 100 years later, were incinerated in the Upper Big Branch mine operated by Massey Energy. And the same damn thing happened. No, it wasn't. Don Blankenship. No, it didn't have nothing to do with the fact that we don't give a damn about any more about a human being than we do a draft mule. It's just one of them things that happens. It's dangerous business. To the point that one widow interviewed on CNN said, "Well, we always knowed it was dangerous." I don't know if this is apropos of anything, but, well, yes, it is. Because it speaks to what Texas Betsy said about, do they want them to work till they're 90? To my dear friends, this is Saturday morning, 8 o'clock, March the 6th, 1915. We are all still alive, but not knowing long, God will spare me. So, dear friends, should it be God's will that I must die, you will find on me a gold watch and a purse with $10.90, and the rest of my belongings is at John Sewell's house, such as trunk and clothes. So please notify my father and restore everything safely to him. So God being my helper, I will close. M. Derenge. My father address is Mike Derenge, Leloot or Springdale, West Virginia. Imagine for a moment trying to write that. As from the tomb, 47 miners. This is from the Fayette Tribune of March 11th, 1915. This is some of that language I was talking with Bill about. As from the tomb, 47 survivors of Leyland walk away from the mine behind Braddis for 4 days. Had water, but many were forced to chew shoe tops to satisfy terrible pangs of hunger. Total dead is estimated at 125. Survivors, 53. Put a little bit of bite in the. Took a little bit of a bite, but not a big one. A little bit of a bite out of the profits of the New River and Pocahontas Coal Company. But it was still a good year for the fellas that dressed in suits and never got their shoes dirty. As from the tomb, 47 miners came out of Leyland Mine alive Saturday morning. For 4 days and nights, they had been behind a Braddis in a side entry, 1 mile underground, waiting for air to reach them that would permit their escape. Their prayers were answered when the big fan at the drift mouth was reversed Friday night and the good air began to whistle past their prison. The appearance of the entombed miners walking out of the mine was a greater surprise than the news of the explosion. They had been mourned as dead, and coffins and new-made graves were in readiness for every one of them. None of those engaged in the rescue work believed there was a living being could survive the deadly gases that had filled the mine for 100 hours. The real rescuer of the 47 was the man who thought to reverse the movement of the fan. Credit for this act is generally accorded John Lang, former chief of the state mining department. Had the fan been reversed 2 or 3 days sooner, it is the opinion of many that other lives would have been saved. 2 or 3 days sooner. The coroner went on to note that many of the dead he found were freshly dead. And then there's a reference. The total of those who came out alive is 53. Of the 47 men to come out alive, about 15 of them were Native Americans. That doesn't mean they were Indians. That means they were not recent immigrants. Charlie and Quincy Caldwell, John Fitzpatrick and his son Lester, Val Clendenin, Howard Hugard, Hugh McMillan, Thomas Whalen and son John, and G.H. Henson were among the survivors. The graves for Fitzpatrick and his son had been dug beside those of his brother and son, whose bodies had been recovered and buried. Dear God, whole families. And there is reference in this story, and the reason it had resonance with me, there is reference in this story to a 72-year-old man who survived. 72. When we read that, I shared it with Ferg. And I said, son, do you think a 72-year-old man is working in a coal mine in 1915 because he just can't stand the burden of not working anymore? Eric looked at me and said, he would have starved to death if he hadn't kept working, wouldn't he? I said, precisely, because this is an America with no Social Security in it, an America the way the Republican Party wants it to be again, where people lift themselves up by their own bootstraps. Hugh McMillan anticipating death wrote, in case we don't get out of our prison. Prison! I'm writing a few lines to our loving dear ones. Everyone in the main, from the main heading and all the entries below 10 and above 12 from the 9th are here. John Whalen and Father are here, safe, all hoping that the rescuers will reach us in time and all praying to our Savior that such will happen, trusting to God that the air will last until they reach us. I am writing to my wife Mary to bring up the kiddies loving their Savior as I am now. How our sins creep up in our faces in a time like this. Love to all, Hugh McMillan. He survived. On the bodies of several of the foreigners were found considerable sums of money. The money was usually carried in a leather garter. Several had over $100 in gold thus secreted, and one had over $300. One Italian, supposed to have $1,500, was found to have nothing on his person. It is believed to have been hidden away by him, and in all probability will never be found. Heh, please. This was in America, where a 72-year-old had to go to work in a death hole. Because, well, that's the way capitalism likes it. Leyland, the name henceforth will be associated with unpleasant memories. Unpleasant memories. Perhaps the name of the town will be changed again, as was done in the case of Stewart and Peral, when Colonel Joe Bury opened up the operation. He called the place Gentry. About 2 years ago, for some unknown reason, the company had the name of the post office changed to Leyland. Perhaps it would be well now to go back to the original Gentry. Skyland or Cloudland would be very appropriate if part of the old name is to be retained, as the town is on top of the mountain at an elevation of about 2,500 feet. It is said to be the highest elevation at which Fire Creek Seam is mined in the state. And they've died like that for 100 years. And three miners still die every year from black lung. And make no mistake, the people who die will tell you that they do so to feed their families. Or would tell you. Or the dying will tell you. But that ain't it. They're dying for shareholders. In Boston, in New York, in St. Louis, executives in Richmond and Chicago. That's who the dying's being done for. Even in 1915. The survival of a man 72 years old. And what I found interesting and could not find any reference for was whether that 72-year-old got to have the dignity of the remainder of his life, or whether he shook the dust off, knocked the dust off, got a bath, and went back to work. To the boys in London and New York and Boston and Pittsburgh and Philly and Richmond, and Chicago, and Cleveland, and Detroit, and St. Louis. And by the way, just before we run out of time, I said I wanted to go back to this, and I did. Cassie took time. She heard the story about the two children, one in Texas, one in Alabama. And she said, shall I go over one more time for the horn listening audience how important it is for children who are beaten at home to have a safe place at school where they know they won't be hit? I can't even imagine where I would be without that in my life. As it is, the violence I witnessed and experienced in my home throughout my childhood has had a huge negative impact on who I am. Cassie's still getting well. Getting better, still recovering, likely always will. So in an America where we would have a hissy if we tried to pass a law saying you can't beat children, understand this. South Sudan says you can't beat children. Albania says you can't beat children. The Republic of Congo says you can't beat children. You can't beat children in Kenya, Tunisia, Poland, Liechtenstein, Luxembourg, the Republic of Moldova, Costa Rica, Togo, Spain, Venezuela, Uruguay, Portugal, New Zealand, Netherlands, Greece, Hungary, Romania, Ukraine, Iceland, Germany, Israel, Bulgaria, Croatia, Latvia, Denmark, Cyprus, Austria, Norway, Finland, or Sweden. But in America, the problem isn't beating children. It's just that we don't know how to beat them the right way. Shouldn't beat them to death. Just beat them on their little behinds. That's why God made them so soft and cushiony, so that they can learn to hear through their buttocks. Welcome to America. So that'll close us out this evening. We close out falling short, having fallen short, but not as short as we would have been without the help of Gene. Thank you, Gene. And perhaps by the time this thing reruns and repeats and gets picked up on the podcast, maybe we will meet up Darlene's challenge, and I'll let you know if we do. If we don't, we'll finish it off tomorrow evening. As it is, we need we're about $300 in the hole. It'll be $450 again tomorrow night because there's $150 every evening. Thank you, Darlene. Thank you profoundly. Thank you to everyone who helped out. Thank you to Karen and Gene. Thank you to Beth. Thank you to Sal. Thank you, everyone, who makes all of this stay going. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. You're never far from all of our thoughts. Thank you to John Fox in Australia. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. He's never sent a bill. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AICACT.org. We added more new co-sponsors over the weekend. That's huge. We're up to 42 now, and you had a hand in that. Thank you. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next on the Horn.